following interview with James Fletcher by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on May 15, 1986. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
How was it you came to work for the Nixon administration in 1969? What brought you into the administration?
That's a personal question. It's a question of my motivation at the time. I was working for the Rand Corporation. I had been in an advisory position. I've been in advisory positions through various government agencies. And I thought that it would be interesting for a while to be on the policy-making side as opposed to the advisory side. I was recommended to Mr. Mayo, then designated to run the Bureau of the Budget by various people. He offered me the job of assistant to director of the BOD with responsibilities for national security.
That became the OMB shortly thereafter.
It became under study. It became the OMB 17 months into the Nixon administration.
How long were you with the Bureau of the Budget and then OMB?
I was there approximately 2 years.
And where you went to?
I went to the Atomic Energy Commission as chairman in the summer of 1971. So I stayed on at the UPOB OMB for, I guess it's close to 30 months.
Now, in early 1973, you left the Atomic Energy Commission chairmanship and became director of Central Intelligence.
That's right.
Now, why did Nixon appoint you to that post? What were the reasons?
Well, I think that's a question that you better ask Mr. Nixon.
Yeah.
Early in the administration, I had responsibility for the national security area, I was urged by the president to, Mr. Mayo was urged by the president, and specifying that I would do the study on the, a study on reducing outlays for the intelligence community. The president had been approached by George Mahon, who was then chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the House, who said that expenditures on intelligence were simply getting out of hand. He at that time mentioned the number of $5 billion. As you recall, we were reducing the Department of Defense, and the intelligence budget is buried in the Department of Defense. As the overall DOD budget came down, it was essential to reduce intelligence outlays, and in addition, both Mahon and the President felt that we were spending too much on intelligence anyhow. So the President came into it from the outset with the view that intelligence expenditures should be reduced. In addition to that, as you may know, Mr. Nixon was not particularly fond of the Central Intelligence Agency, and I believe that that was reflected in his judgments at the time. He had the view, I am told, that the CIA discussions of the missile gap had cost him the election in 1960. Whether or not, and to whatever extent he may have had that view, the fact of the matter was that he really was not very fond of the Central Intelligence Agency and of many of the senior personnel at the agency.
No.
How did he come to appoint me? Once Mr. Schultz came in as director of the OMB, he talked to Nixon, and Nixon talked again about the need for an intelligence study. It was then that I turned out the study, now known as the Schlesinger Report, that described the alternatives that the president had for restructuring of the intelligence community. I then more or less disappeared to the Atomic Energy Commission. But after the election of 1972, Nixon and his senior advisors were busily emptying out personnel who had served in the first term. And as you recall, he requested a resignation letter from everybody. I was called up to Camp David sometime in December of 72, and the president and Haldeman and Ehrlichman, I think, were there and indicated that the president wanted me to go to the CIA. I was perfectly happy at the AEC, and I urged them not to move Mr. Helms out. But they listened politely, but paid no further attention to my remarks. A few days later, it became clear that they treated the prior conversation about my probable move to the CIA as a fait accompli.
Now, when you were at CIA, who were the people that advised you on questions that were involved Iran? For example, the Kurdish question. What kind of people did you rely upon for policy advice?
Well, I did not need to rely on policy advice at that time. We had an ongoing operation. The attitude of the Iraqi government at that time was distinctly hostile to the United States, and the attitude of the Iranian government was quite friendly. I inherited a policy, and therefore it did not seem to me essential to analyze the merits of a policy that was already in place. As you may know, I only spent 4 months at the CIA, and between the breaking in process and the Watergate problem that busted over the agency, that there was not a great deal of time to reflect on external activities.
Mm-hmm. So you just continued the Kurdish operation, basically, while you were there for the 6 months?
Well, I'm not sure I want to confirm or deny.
Okay. Let me go on to something else. Maybe a more general question about the U.S. and Iran during the 70s as a whole. Maybe back to the CIA for a second. What was the overall importance of Iran to U.S. foreign policy goals during the Nixon and Ford administrations?
I think that there was some difference in tone between the two. I think that Mr. Nixon and the Shah had a personal relationship and a degree of warmth that was not true of the Ford-Shah relationship. President Ford tended to follow the commitments of his predecessor and the advice of Secretary Kissinger, but I don't think that the degree of commitment was there, and consequently some of the things to which we had committed ourselves during the Nixon years, those commitments might not have been made in the 4 years. One can never tell. The overall relationship during that period, obliterating differences between the two, was one of great closeness. probably excessive closeness, not only from the standpoint of the United States, but probably from the standpoint of the well-being of the Shah and Iran both. The closeness was in part an outgrowth of the public atmosphere in the United States. And our involvement in the Vietnam War, which, as you know, continued in diminuendo until 1975, although U.S. forces were effectively withdrawn after 73, the public opposition to the war was, to say the least, substantial. And as a result, and the congressional opposition as well, and as a result, the possibility of the United States using its own military resources for the protection of the region of the Persian Gulf, given public and congressional attitudes, were regarded as low. What is referred to as the Nixon Doctrine of relying on the Shah and other regional powers was not so much a decision taken as an ideal outcome, but driven by the constraints that were established during the Korean War period. Therefore, you had the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was established constraints. There was the belief that we had to create a new security structure in the region of the Persian Gulf. The British indicated that they were in the process of withdrawing. And there was this intimate relationship between the President, President Nixon, and the Shah. President Nixon had a failing, that he tended to believe those who were close to him emotionally had greater strength and capability than was actually the case, and the Shah certainly fell under that rubric. We overloaded the Shah in terms of putting him in a position that was greater than his resources, his real resources, could bear. We overloaded the Shah, too, in my judgment, in calling upon him to perform missions that resulted in reinforcing his own estimate of his own importance. But that was a reflection, as I say, of the constraints on the ability of the United States to replace the British as the British withdrew from the region. A good deal of wishful thinking about how much the Shah could do as the regional protector, and the personal relationship between Nixon and the Shah.
What accounted for this relationship?
Now, I should say one other thing. As a result of this relationship, we made commitments to the Shah that were open-ended commitments. Those commitments antedated my involvement in the problem and go back to, I think, the meetings at Persepolis and other places in which the president, in effect, said that the Shah could not only rely on the United States, whatever he wanted he could have. That was the background.
Now, how do policymakers generally define the U.S. interest in Iran in this period?
I don't know that they're very explicit in defining it. I think that it filtered down from the commitments that Nixon and Kissinger had made in the early days of the administration. To the extent that it was defined, it wasn't defined all that well. The role of the Shah was of the principal U.S. ally and as the strong man of the Gulf. serving as a proxy, as it were, for American power. But that was rather ill-defined, and needless to say, while that was the view at the top, many of the functionaries in the government didn't necessarily subscribe to it, most particularly the people in the Department of Defense.
That's what you mean to say. When people look at Iran as a country in that area, what was the importance assigned to it? Why was it seen as important?
It was seen as important for a number of reasons. The first reason was the real estate that it occupied. Going back to the 1950s and Secretary Dulles' attempt to establish what was the short-lived Baghdad Pact that became CENTO, the Shah was the centerpiece, as it were, of CENTO. That was the northern tier. With the passage of the years, the northern tier grew in importance. Why did it grow in importance? When it was set up, the dependency of the industrial world on the oil resources of the Persian Gulf were limited. With each passing year, more or less, that dependency grew so that the Persian Gulf oil resources had become critical to the industrial world and to the rest. And for that reason, the tier, which was served as a kind of band, presumably keeping the Soviets from penetrating southward to reach those oil resources, to say nothing of the historic interest in the warm water ports, as expressed at least by legend from the time of Peter the Great, became more and more important. I don't think that at the time of the Baghdad Pact it was fully appreciated. I know it wasn't fully appreciated how important the Persian Gulf is to become. So the first thing is the real estate, where it was located. The second thing was the role of the Shah in CENTO. The Shah was, as it were, an unencumbered U.S. ally. After the price revolution of 1973, he was not only an ally, but he was an ally with lots of cash to spend and one who had a certain authority with regard to the oil price that had become critical. And finally, he was a source of military power that could be, finally and not least, a source of military power that was believed to be capable of serving as a stabilizing presence in the region, outside of the role of the northern tier as a band to prevent Soviet moving southward. It was also going to serve to stabilize the Gulf itself, as the Dhofar involvement suggested.
A question about the CIA period. So maybe if you can answer them, you can answer them. If you can't, we'll just go on. Now, during the 50s and early 60s, the CIA station chief in Tehran generally had a fairly close working relationship with the Shah. Was this something that was still the case in the early 70s, this kind of close relationship on a working basis?
It would be my impression, and I should not say that it's more than that, that had ceased, that the Shah had gradually become more elevated, and that he would deal increasingly with the ambassador, and it was natural for an ambassador, not to specify any particular one, to want those kinds of discussions to go through the ambassador rather than through the station chief. And then, of course, when Mr. Helms became ambassador, he was—he could be regarded as one who was knowledgeable about the functions of a station chief, and one might say he was a glorified and elevated station chief. So I don't think that the relationship would have survived in that period. I have no recollection of any such close involvement between the Shah and others. The Shah, as you may know, became to some extent increasingly remote as the years passed.
In the 60s and early 70s, through the 70s, the agency used Iran as a listening post on Soviet missile tests. Now, it's been alleged that during the 60s, press later, it's not clear to me, that the...
Well, that's your statement.
Yeah,
about the listening post.
Yeah, right. It's been alleged the CIA agreed not to spy on the Shah in order to get use of these sites for listening on missile tests. Was there anything to those allegations that you can speak on?
I couldn't comment on that.
Another question, this might be one you can. At the time you were CIA director, did the agency do much monitoring of social and political conditions inside Iran? Did you get a sense of the social and political conditions in the country from reports that you read?
No, Iran was not. I did not, I had enough to do, and Iran was not at the top of our priority list. In general, the attitude within the agency was, I think, that you had, as ambassador there, a man who was quite knowledgeable about such matters, and sense of things probably was good enough. I think that there may have been some tendency for the agency to grow a little complacent with a former director as the ambassador.
Well, during this period, early to mid-70s, were there any particular concerns at all about the stability of the Shah's rule in Iran? People assessed
in the early and mid 70s?
Through the mid 70s.
Well, I had considerable concerns about it. And I expressed them repeatedly. They were not concerns that went to the intelligence data, they were concerns that reflected a general analysis of the kinds of forces that were at work in Iran. I urged the Shah, the first time I met him, to use his resources prudently rather than to squandering them on a diverse set of military hardware. And a principal reason that I gave was the lack of a substantial body of trained technicians inside of the country. And to the extent that he acquired complex military hardware and many models of it, he established logistical requirements that would have gradually absorbed more and more of those trained personnel, so that fewer and fewer were available for the normal civilian activities of the society. There is that general observation. I was quite concerned about it, that the heedless growth of the armed services would result in an excessive drawing away of specific resources, in this case, trained technicians. I was not worried about the cash, the overall monetary requirements, but its direct impact on the availability of trained people. It seemed to me that the Shah's notions of modernizing the country in particular, that the unplanned growth of the armed services would defeat some of those schemes. That was a general thought. As it turned out, it was more accurate than ever I thought at the time. The other point that I should make is that a simple historical point made by every historian since de Tocqueville, which is the time of transformation of these societies, that they become particularly unstable, that as you root up people, move them from traditional settings and from traditional occupations into new occupations, and particularly if there is a growth of real income that might be interrupted, that the society is far more vulnerable than when it is functioning as a traditional society. That's sort of a general observation. One was worried about that in a general way, but of course general worries tend to be overtaken by specific worries, and the point that I emphasized more than anything else was the very limited number of trained people in the country and the desirability of not allowing them to be engrossed, as it were, by the military establishment. However, the Shah, I never mentioned the latter point about the Tocqueville and so on to the Shah, because that was the kind of thing that is likely to have irritated him, and I felt the irritation was unnecessary, but I stressed what was the substantive point about trained people. It affected his course of action somewhat, but not significantly, as we can see in retrospect.
When you started out at the CIA, and in the 4 months you were there, did Henry Kissinger discuss with you the rationale for the support of the Kurdish insurgency in Iraq?
As I indicated earlier, this was not a high priority item, and I only spent about 4 months at the agency in total. My recollection now, somewhat obscure, is that indeed Henry did discuss this briefly as one of the things that we were doing. As you may recall, the government of Iraq was highly antagonistic at the time. My recollection is that this was discussed more in terms of creating a problem for the Iraqi regime than it was in terms of support for the Shah's ambitions. That would seem to be an appropriate emphasis for him to make. Although I supported the Shah, I tended to be a little bit more skeptical about the hopes of the administration for the role that the Shah might play, and a little more skeptical about the Shah's ambitions than some of the other members of the administration. That is not to imply that I was as a critic. It was merely that in relative standing I was far more cautious.
It's been alleged that Kissinger and Nixon agreed to the Shah's request for this operation at Persepolis in 72, but only he insisted that they support the operation if he was to play the role of John Darn in the Gulf. Is there some of the quid pro quo that you know about?
I do not know of that.
Yeah.
However, it is quite plausible to me. As you may know, our role was a supportive role. I think that the Shah eagerly wanted the prestige of the United States involved, the backing of the United States, but he was less concerned about the quantitative support. And that he was in a position, given the overall role that we wanted him to play, to demand a quid pro quo. So, while I cannot speak to that myself, and others presumably can, it strikes me as more than plausible.
In July 73, I think, you became Secretary of Defense.
I had served, as I indicated, as Secretary of Defense basically from April and May on. My final confirmation by the Senate was held up for some months by Senator Krautschmeier, But from mid-May on, I was down at the Pentagon most of the time, and with the concurrence of the Armed Services Committee, while my confirmation was pending, I went to the NATO meetings in Europe as de facto Secretary of Defense with the role of Special Presidential Envoy. And if you, therefore, it's quite true that I became formally Secretary of Defense in July, but I had served as Secretary of Defense de facto for some months prior to it.
I wonder, what accounted for this quick transition from CIA to the Pentagon? What decisions have Nixon made?
I can't speak to that. Once again, you ought to speak to Nixon himself. Elliot Richardson was Secretary of Defense. He wanted Elliot over as Attorney General for reasons relating to Watergate, and I forget the precise details at this time. I think that Kleindienst he replaced?
Shortly, yeah.
I think that, of course, Kleindienst had gotten into a peck of trouble, and that created something of a stain on the Department of Justice, and that Elliot Richardson's reputation was such that he could remove that stain. Therefore, they moved Richardson as quickly as they could, and I was the logical choice within the administration.
Okay. Now, when you became Secretary of Defense, had you been briefed or told about the substance of the meetings that Nixon and Kissinger held with the Shah in May of 72 in terms of arms sales decisions? Were you informed, or did you read about them in documents?
I don't recall that I had any direct briefings. As one reflects on it, there were kind of hints at this and that, but there was no documentations. It became clear to me over the period ahead that the relationship was very deep, but no, I cannot recall any explanation of the degree of commitment, and indeed I have not to this day had it confirmed from the participants that those commitments were made, that you can have anything you wanted. I did not at that time believe that such deep commitments had been made, although I understood that that we were supposed in general to support the Shah, because I resisted certain sales, certain commitments by the United States, which I didn't think were in our interest, and sometimes were not in the Shah's interest. On some of them, I just got overruled.
What sales were these? Do you recall the details?
Well, I think that as regards to aircraft, I was allowed to attempt to dissuade the Shah from acquiring certain aircraft. Indeed, ultimately, I persuaded him that he ought not to buy both the F-14 and the F-15. Simply because with forces that small, he should not have two long and complex logistics trains, once again going back to my concern about trained manpower. Then there was the case of the TOW missile, which I got to be critical because the Shah wanted to put a plant in country for the production of the TOW, and I was hesitant to allow the technology to produce the TOW to go outside of the country. And I dragged my feet on that. effect, but when the decision was made, the decision was, yes, indeed, we were going to go with the Shah's request. Once again, I was permitted to attempt to dissuade the Shah, but if the Shah insisted, he won.
Did he in this case?
I beg pardon?
Did he in this case of the Toe?
He did indeed in the case of the Toe. And I noticed all of that, but I did not know that he had been, I still did not know, or I've never been informed that whatever he wanted, he could have as the statements about the Persepolis conference suggest. I've never asked Nixon about that at the time or subsequently, whether or not that commitment was as deep as it was.
So in effect, Iranian...
There was, of course, negotiations on all sorts of things, Bell helicopters and so forth. But I thought my general fear was the leakage of high technology items into a region in which one could not predict the future with certainty. That's not to say I expected the Shah to be overthrown, but I thought that the instabilities in the region were such that one should not encourage the export of high technology. Should not encourage the export of the capability to produce high technology items. That was what was different about the Toe plant. Now, we were engaged in selling the Shah high technology items, and one might worry about that too, but it was less worrisome than the provision of the capability to produce. As I say, I raised these questions, and each of these cases, my arguments tended to receive relatively short shrift, from which one might conclude that there had been a prior commitment, but I was never told about it.
These were discussions with Kissinger, NSC meetings, and you made these objections at NSC meetings?
No, they were all private discussions, yeah. Meetings for luncheon and that sort of thing.
Kissinger, yeah. And others. Yeah. Okay. So, and you're saying
by that time, Nixon was reasonably fully absorbed with the Watergate problem. And these kinds of things were beneath his tension level, by and large. The Shah came here, as I recall it, in the summer of 73. September of 73, was it? Or?
That's right, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I think it was September 73. It may have been 74, but it was, I think, shortly after I became Secretary of Defense, and I pressed him to on some of these points that I've previously mentioned about the importance of maintaining a balanced military force, and not too heavily involved in procurement. That was toward the end of the period in which Nixon was reasonably fully engaged with government before he became inundated by the Watergate affair.
Before I answer about that visit of the Shah, I have a few general questions about the arms sales and their implications. Now, was there much concern in DOD or other agencies the Iranian arms buildup might aggravate a regional arms race and lead to further instability in the region? Was that considered as a problem or a possible problem?
I think that was used as from time to time as an argument within the Pentagon, but it was only an argument. The Pentagon is not given either institutionally or emotionally to deep and excessive neuroses about the arms races, regional or otherwise. And I think that, of course, tends to be a failing. It was justified, probably, in this case, to a considerable extent by the attitudes taken by the Iraqis. The fact that our arming of Iran intended to reinforce the inclination of the Iraqis to run to the Soviet Union, however, was not given a great deal of weight. I think in these matters that one point passes a point of no return, as it were. And that is the appropriate kind of question to raise before one develops an extensive arms relationship. Once one's engaged and the other party in that arms race, the Iraqis in this case, have turned to the Soviets as suppliers, the tendency is for that relationship between the third party and the Soviets to obliterate other concerns. And that relationship tends to justify thereafter arms sales.
Now, some students of arms sales have suggested that by making Iran more dependent upon U.S. high-technology weapons, the Nixon and Ford administrations hope to be in a better position to influence the Shah's political and military moves in the region through a process of dependency.
That's the kind of academic suggestion. It's reflection of the academic capacity to see logical relationships and infer from a logical relationship that it may have been a principal motivation. No, the fact of the matter is that we had an intimate relationship with the Shah, and that the notion of using arms sales as a way of high-technology arms sales and make it dependency as a way of making him more responsive was pretty far off. What is true, and is generally true about arms sales, is the belief that the arms relationship, not necessarily involving high technology, breeds an intimacy that is politically useful, and that certainly applied in this case, as it does in almost any case that I can think of offhand. The Shah, providing the arms for the Shah, brought him closer to the United States and therefore more responsive to our suggestions. But it wasn't a dependency on high technology items. That's carrying logic too far.
Now, as you said a few minutes ago, the same month you officially became Secretary of Defense, the Shah visited Washington, D.C. Can you recall the general purposes of this visit to the district?
I don't recall the general purposes of the thing. It was, other than it was the continuation of the relationship that had been engendered in the early years of the Nixon administration, and a renewal of vows, as it were, a new renewal of marital vows. The Shah tended to develop his strategic hypotheses, most of which involved the Soviets and destroying Pakistan by Soviet subordination of the Baluchis and the Pushtuns. It was his belief that the Soviets were going to move against Afghanistan as politically a fact that became much more true some years later, at the time that Daoud was overthrown. But Daoud was regarded by the Shah as pretty much a Soviet tool. That's not correct, but he pretty much regarded it in that light. The dismemberment of Pakistan was his principal concern, and its relationships for the stability of the region as a whole, and particularly Iran itself. The Shah, as you may know, since he was an absolute monarch, tended to spin out these theories in Tehran, and as he did so, he was surrounded by a group of people who say, "Ah, how wise you are, Your Majesty, how insightful." And so he tended to be unchecked, as it were, in the development of his strategic views, some of which were soundly based, but some of which became pretty fanciful.